KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Mid-40s.
We know that when drugs are legal, they're cheaper, they're more available than they're promoted, as we've seen for alcohol. So I think alcohol would be the last model we'd want to look at for marijuana.
There has never been a significant advantage for charters, whether you look at black students, Hispanic students, low-income students, or students in cities.
This is a democracy. We were concerned about what the public wanted to see. And, you know, when you consider the fact that this has been absolutely prohibited for 80 years, 502 is an incredible step forward, and it was done with deliberation and thoughtfulness.
We're going to talk about what happens now that the marijuana law is put in place. We're also going to talk about funding schools. And we're going to start, though, with ballots still being counted. Where are we right now? Cheryl Huff is the director of King County Elections. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello.
Thanks for talking to us. How many ballots does King County have left to count?
We have probably around the 220 range.
220,000
range. We have, this afternoon, we'll start, our crews will start working with some of those ballots that have been set aside for further review, and we have all of the military and overseas ballots. That's a fairly large number to go through those, because we have to have the follow-up information from those. So we still have processing in those areas, but the total numbers are in the 200,000 range.
When do you project to be finished?
We will be working on Saturday, waiting to see if we will also be working on Monday. But it should be in the next couple of days where we will, through today, what we're doing today, and Saturday, will be really, really close.
How is turnout compared to 4 and 8 years ago?
Higher. Turnout was fabulous. A part of the whole time issue that everyone is fixated on has to do with the fact that so many people voted on, you know, we have 985,000 ballots in our office. That's history. So in our state, with the emphasis, fortunately, I believe, that is on access and on doing those things that we can to make sure we can count the voters' ballots, those things are time-consuming, and they also are required by law. So it takes longer. I appreciate that. It's difficult when there's close ranges, but it's also a factor of integrity in the way we conduct elections.
Okay, I hear in your voice and your response, and I saw also the Seattle Times this morning, some other articles. Yes, there's been criticism, and you're feeling it. I want to ask you one thing about that, two things about that, but this is one. Is part of the reason it's taking long because of the amount of money in your budget that you have to spend on machinery?
Absolutely.
And overtime?
Not. Absolutely not. I want to make that very, very clear. Everybody jumps to all kinds of places with this. They don't want to listen to some of the real reasons for this. But we have been very, very fortunate in my office. There's confidence in us, number one, at the executive level and the council level. And we have given the support we request, period.
You were quoted in the paper as saying, here's what I know about working people until midnight and having them back early in the morning. That's when you have mistakes. This is in the Seattle Times this morning.
Then that's
it's
right.
King County
that's
workers right. Go home at 8:30. But why not have two or three shifts of trained workers?
We can't accommodate two or three shifts of workers. We have the numbers that we have in terms of managers and supervisors, and there have to be managers and supervisors on our floor for processing. That's a bandwidth issue. We have extremely well-trained people, but I, quite frankly, don't consider working people 24 hours a day, or even, we're working people now 12 to 14, 16 hours a day, and we're all getting weary. But that isn't the answer to, again, you know, anyway.
What is the answer?
We've provided the explanation over and over again.
All right. Can I ask a different question then?
Sure.
Would it be easier if the requirement for the ballots were to be in by Election Day rather than postmarked on Election Day? Would it be quicker?
Oh, absolutely. We are not only a postmark state, we are a voter intent state, which means that by law, we look at ballots that have issues with them, that have been damaged, where there may be a question about what a voter intended. Those ballots go to a canvas board, to our canvas board. But that part of our state process for elections takes time.
What is electronic signature verification that Oregon has, and how is it different than what Washington does?
It's the same as what Washington has, but again, they are an election day deadline state.
And is it substantially faster if you had election day deadline, or day and a half faster? I mean, what do you think?
Well, it is. You don't have ballots coming in over a long period of time. We have ballots coming in over a 3-week time period. And so that in itself is different.
Theoretically, you could still have
what they have in their offices on at the end of the night on election day.
Theoretically, you could have ballots coming in up even today, right? If they're postmarked,
they're lower in numbers certainly, and even lower in numbers in terms of those that have valid postmark.
One other thing, you said we had a huge turnout. I'm just curious. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyways. In terms of registered voters and in terms of eligible voters, what was the eligible voter turnout? Do you know?
I don't have a total on that yet. We are, the eligible voter turnout is...
It's always a lot lower, right? I mean, it's people who register and the people who actually are eligible to vote. The people who are eligible to vote, that's a lot bigger population than turns out, isn't it?
Well, the eligible voters are... Every registered voter.
Oh, all right. So if you're registered, you're eligible. I see how you're making the distinction.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a lot of people who don't register, could be voting.
If they vote, they vote provisionals, and those are investigated before they're counted. If they're not eligible to vote, then those provisional votes are not counted.
Cheryl Huff, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Cheryl Huff is the director of King County Elections. One thing we do know is what's happening with the Initiative 502, the initiative to legalize marijuana. Washington State voters approved that legislation December 6th. People in possession of a small amount will not be penalized by the state. Still illegal federally, though, so there's still a question of what the federal government might do. And that's what people are asking about. I talked to Pete Holmes, the city attorney, earlier about those issues and some house cleaning issues, including the fact that on December 6th, you will be legally allowed to possess pot, but not in any way to purchase it. I said that's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it?
It is, but it's a one-year conundrum that, when you contrast against 80 years of prohibition, seems like a reasonable time to wait to sort out the details.
Does that mean that December 6th at midnight, when I expect some people will think it's time for a smoke out in the streets of the city, they can just do that?
Absolutely not. I think the best thing for listeners to keep in mind is that we're modeling this after our regulations for hard alcohol. We don't allow drinking in public. We don't allow smoking marijuana in public.
Is that modeled city by city, or is that going to be a state jurisdictional issue?
This is a statewide initiative. It applies everywhere.
So if the city of Seattle says, look, not only can't you smoke pot out in the street, but you can't pass it, I don't know, just to make something up, on the street, could they have additional rules in place or not?
It remains a felony to distribute marijuana, and after the one-year rulemaking period, only state-licensed stores can sell marijuana. And keep in mind that medical marijuana remains a separate, unaffected set of laws. Medical marijuana patients can still continue to grow their own and or obtain it from a designated provider.
Now, Pete Holmes, who is going to be involved in the conversations over the rules and the implementation of this law?
On the rules themselves, the State Liquor Control Board will take the lead, but they will work on rules in conjunction with the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. This is going to be a rulemaking period for a year in which we'll have full public input, but the conversations that I think will take place will be with law enforcement at all levels, federal, state, and local.
Pete Holmes, the city attorney for Seattle. As you said, I hear in there control, tax... The critics of this said in the end it's not going to be legalization, because it's not going to be that much easier for somebody to share their marijuana, to grow marijuana. It's only going to be that they can buy it at a store, go to the privacy of, I guess, their own homes, and that would be it, and smoke it or vaporize it or whatever they're doing. How restricted does it feel to you at this point, then, as it's implemented?
You know, there are some restrictions that are more onerous than with alcohol. For instance, you know, it's a simple misdemeanor for an adult to furnish alcohol to a minor. It will remain a felony if someone furnishes marijuana to a minor. But we think that those are appropriate distinctions. And there are probably some people who think that they do not have total freedom unless they can smoke a joint walking down the streets of Seattle. You know, it's a balancing act when you live in a civil society. We have to have some rules, and those rules apply to alcohol. I don't think anyone claims that alcohol prohibition still exists, even though you can't drink it in public. There are real restrictions on the use of alcohol. We've tried to tailor these to an appropriate degree with marijuana. This is a democracy. We were concerned about what the public wanted to see. And, you know, when you consider the fact that this has been absolutely prohibited for 80 years, 502 is an incredible step forward, and it was done with deliberation and thoughtfulness. So it will be really difficult for the federal government to ignore how much thought and care went into substituting a regulatory regime that is going to accomplish more legitimate public safety goals than the current policy.
And in terms of implementation, those counties that voted against it, they still have to put it in place. Can they put on more restrictions than a county that voted for it?
Conceivably. This is a statewide rule, but a statewide law. But the rulemaking that will take place in the next year can address issues like that. If, you know, we have dry counties, and or at least did over in our history, and I think we want to allow room for some local variations. But it has been important that we put an end to those 10,000 annual arrests by state law enforcement officials for simple possession, you know, nonviolent possession of marijuana that is costing us dearly and destroying lives. That needs to be brought to an end. How accommodating local governments are to the state licensed marijuana stores is something that we'll see over the next year.
And on the flip side of this, does 502 make any provision if somebody says, well, like a bar, I would like to open a place where people can, inside my establishment, get high?
Well, we still have the public smoking laws. They apply to marijuana and tobacco equally. So they certainly have that hurdle to overcome.
Well, let's say it's all edibles.
If it's all edibles, you know, Steve, I'm not really sure how that would play out. Part of this has to do with law enforcement priorities and the rulemaking that takes place over the next year. But, you know, you got to ask yourself, how concerned would the public be if people were sitting in a private establishment consuming brownies? I'm not sure how concerned they would be. They would certainly want to make sure that people leaving that establishment weren't driving impaired, and that's an appropriate law enforcement effort.
And finally, you know, people are saying this is a symbolic victory for legalization advocates. Kevin Sabet, who we're going to talk to in a minute, is quoted as saying it's going to be short-lived. They're facing an uphill battle with implementing this in the face of presidential opposition, face of federal enforcement opposition. You've heard this already. How does the state respond, even now, even today, to the federal government's listing of marijuana?
It's, you know, unhelpful conversation to hear those comments. What 502 represents, and I think the effort in Colorado, is an attempt by very sober-minded, concerned public officials to a failed policy.
Well, I get that. I get that, and that was the campaign conversation. But now you've won. Are you having conversations with federal officials at all? Has anybody called you at all that said, well, all right, now let's move to this new conversation? Or is it silence from federal officials at this point?
Other than former federal officials, I guess it's been silent. But this is just a few days after the election, and we're reaching out at all levels. We'll be talking to our congressional leaders. We're talking to law enforcement. I think the decision will ultimately come from the White House, but there will be a collaboration among all of these entities. And I think that again, reason will prevail. 502, I think, complements federal law enforcement. I think we share the same objectives. We don't want marijuana in the hands of youth. We want it regulated, and we certainly want it to stop funding criminal enterprises.
It's Pete Holmes, Seattle City Attorney. He supported Initiative 502. Kevin Sepet was senior advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, 2009-2011. He was under Gil Kerlikowske. He's now an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Florida, consultant on drug policy. Kevin Sebett, unhelpful comments, because there has to be a discussion now because these two states have passed these laws. What's your response to that?
Well, thanks for having me on the
Thank
show,
you.
Steve. Sure. Well, I think they're real comments, and they're a reality check to some people, I think, whose heads are still in some smoke in the clouds. On a high of being so excited about making this symbolic victory a couple days ago. I mean, it's not surprising that it won in Washington, given that there was millions of dollars of out-of-state funding by legalization supporters. And people in prevention, treatment, doctors, and others that I talked to and worked with over the last few months in Washington, they're extremely worried about this. But at the same time, they also have a day job. They're saving lives, and they're not able to put together the wonderful campaign that I have to compliment the yes side of being able to do. So, look, when you're plastering the airwaves the last week with things like prevention is what we need and this would eliminate Mexican drug cartels and you're spending $3 million doing it, that's going to be pretty effective. Unfortunately, they're empty promises.
Because the federal government has many tools with which it can stop the use of marijuana in the state?
Well, they're empty tools they're empty promises for a lot of reasons. So, yeah, I mean, first of all, first and foremost, marijuana is still illegal, according to the federal government. And so this directly contradicts it. I think I chuckled when I heard the city attorney say that it's complements federal law enforcement. It actually runs directly in violation. And I know many people who support this, including people like Pete Holmes and others, come from a good place when they're supporting this. I'm not attacking that. The issue is when you look at the evidence and you look at public health, the science has not changed on marijuana, even if Washington voters, half of them, thought that the policy should change. The science still shows that 1 in 6 kids who try marijuana do become addicted. Now, that's not the vast majority, but 1 in 6 is also not trivial. It's actually similar to alcohol. That's
the argument that's been made. Don't you think that at some point the federal government looks and says, well, here's two states, mm-hmm. just like with alcohol, we could be facing a rush to get rid of the same kind of prohibition, and does the federal government then look at other alternatives in conversation or not?
I agree. We should look at other alternatives. We need a more public health approach. We need more education and treatment. Legalization's not the way to do that. Why? First of all, we all know that kids get alcohol more than any other drug, and that's legal. And we're saying we're going to keep these out of the hands of kids. It becomes more normalized. The other thing we know is that criminal organizations, and it's a wonderful scare tactic to bring up cartels and evil, scary drug dealers and say they're all going to be eliminated if we pass this. However, we know that the vast minority of revenues from criminal organizations comes from marijuana. If we really want to attack criminal organizations in Washington, we better legalize not only every drug, including chief among them cocaine and heroin, but we also better legalize human trafficking, sex trafficking, and political violence, because that's actually where they get their money from.
Well, this is my question. Do you think anybody in your former office of the National Drug Control Policy is going to pick up a phone and start talking to the state about some sort of way to implement this law and work it through, or do you think they're going to clamp down?
Well, here's the deal. There are parts of the law that I don't think trip up federal law, and frankly, I don't think they should. So the parts about the drugged driving, the parts about frankly, removal of criminal penalties for possession. Remember, this is not a dichotomous issue. This is not the only alternative to the current approach is legalization. This is where I differ maybe from, I don't know if I differ from my federal colleagues on this. I probably don't, but I definitely differ from others who think that it's either prohibition or legalization. It's not. We can remove criminal penalties, remove the stigma of arrest, look at the disadvantaged issue. That's a huge issue, disadvantaged communities. We can do all of that without legalizing marijuana and contradicting federal law. So Now, unfortunately, this law does put the state in a very awkward position. The governor is against this. It's going to be extremely difficult. State employees right now are shaking in their boots. They're going to have to deliver on state and city employees a law that's illegally federally. And we saw Chris Gregoire already veto the expanded medical marijuana bill. That expanded medical marijuana bill, the reason she vetoed it, she said, is because she didn't want to put her state employees at risk of arrest. Why do we think this would be any different?
Well, we're going to find out. We're going to find out, and I hope we talk to you about it again in the future, Kevin Sabet, because it'll be unfolding in our state for the next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Kevin Sabet was senior advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy 2009-2011. He now works at the University of Florida and consults on drug policy. This is Weekday.
It's 9:25. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. During this election season, we heard a lot about funding public schools. So what does a well-funded school system actually look like? Coming up next, we'll pose that question to Diane Ravitch. She's professor of education at NYU. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Mirror Stage, presenting the West Coast premiere of Odin's Horse by Rob Kuhn, a modern twist on a classic Nordic myth, at the Ethnic Cultural Theater, October 24th through November 11th. Tickets at mirrorstage.org, theater that gets people talking.
We have sunny skies and 44 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 48 today. It's supposed to be sunny all day. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight, the low in the low 30s. Sunny again tomorrow, the high in the mid-40s.
So the Washington State Supreme Court has ruled that the state is not meeting its constitutional requirement to amply fund public education. So what does a well-funded school system look like? This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherer. Diane Ravitch has been thinking about school funding and education for a while now. She's research professor of education at New York University, a historian of education. Diane Ravitch, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So let me ask you a question about the history of funding of public schools. Is there a moment in time when where you could look and say, oh, this is adequate funding for a public school system?
You know, the affluent suburban districts have figured it out. They spend a lot of money. They have experienced teachers. They have small class sizes. They make sure that there's physical education every day and that kids have lots of opportunity to be involved in the arts. They have their program for all the children includes history and civics and geography and science and mathematics. What we're doing now in this country is to dumb down education solely to what can be tested, and that's math and reading. And many kids are not getting the arts, and particularly in the big cities, not just in Seattle but across this country, the focus is solely on standardized testing, and that warps the whole purpose of education.
So when I look at a list of per pupil spending, Washington State 45th with $76,000 a year, $7,600 a year, excuse me, per pupil. And I look at Vermont, $15,000, Wyoming below it with $14,000. Is that one way for me to assess whether spending is adequate at per pupil expenditures?
Well, you know, spending alone is not the only measure, but it certainly is an important measure. You can't provide all the facilities and the resources that kids need. And, you know, the other thing that's changed in our society is we have more poverty today than we've had in anyone's memory. We have an income gap between the rich and the poor these days that is something like the days of the robber barons going back 100 years. So we have about 25% of our kids in this country living in dire poverty. We have many children who don't speak English. We haven't had this kind of level of immigration in many decades. And we have many kids with special needs. I mean, there's a lot of toxicity in the environment that we live in. So we have lots of kids who need extra help because they can't hear, they can't see, they have emotional problems, on and on. It used to be back before the 1970s, those kids weren't even admitted to public school. They were off on their own. And we did not have the... the schools are being overwhelmed with kids with special needs. And at the same time, a lot of people are saying, well, I don't want my taxes raised. And I think you in Washington State just passed an initiative to open 40 charter schools. That's not an answer.
All right. Well, let me. So when we look at these expenditures again, and what school districts that are doing it right. You said suburban school districts at the top there, wealthier suburban districts. Is there a significant gap in their spending per pupil, or is just there a significant gap in the population they're educating?
Well, first of all, they spend a lot more because they're affluent. And secondly, the parents are very involved, and they would not stand for having a school where there were no arts. They wouldn't allow a school where recess was eliminated. They would not tolerate the idea that experienced teachers are being replaced by young kids who've just had a few weeks of training. So I think that a lot of this has to do with both money and also a public and parents who say, I don't want that for my child. I won't let you do that.
Diane Ravitch is our guest. We're looking at what it is to amply fund education. So, for example, New Jersey has the highest per pupil expenditure, $17,620 per pupil. The fifth highest graduation rate, 84%. Is that because New Jersey has a lot of suburban areas where they're spending a lot and that gets rolled into their urban areas where they're not spending as much?
New Jersey has tremendous extremes. It has some districts, I think there are a dozen or 15 districts in New Jersey that are highly racially segregated. They're virtually all black and Hispanic, and they are in deep, deep poverty. There are districts like Newark and Camden and Patterson and on where they're just have terrible test scores and they're at the very bottom, and nobody has figured out what's the right thing to do there. But most of New Jersey has an excellent school system. The suburban schools in New Jersey do incredibly well. And if you look at something like the national test, the federal test given by the Federal Department of Education every other year, New Jersey is always either number two or number three across the country. The number one is Massachusetts. That's also a high-spending state.
But they're probably not spending $17,000. That's an average, I imagine, right? And some of those districts are spending a lot less.
Right. Well, you know, even in the very poor districts, I mean, New Jersey has been subject to court orders about equalizing spending. So even the poor districts are not getting underfunded, but they have massive problems, and the schools alone are not able to overcome the kind of concentrated poverty and racial segregation that's been allowed to fester in the state of New Jersey and in many of other states.
So do you have a number, Diane Ravitch, that you think modern American school districts should be spending per pupil? Let's take an urban inner-city school district.
You know, again, I don't think there's a specific number. I think you have to look at what's needed. And where you have students with a lot of disabilities, or a lot of students with disabilities, it's going to cost more. That is the single most expensive item in any school district's budget is special education. And the problem there is that Congress mandated it, and Congress said when they mandated it many years ago that the federal government would put up 40% of the cost, and they've never put up more than about 12 or 13% of the cost. So the federal government could do a lot to ease the burden of the state of Washington and other states if they just paid for what they mandated.
Have you looked overseas to look at spending in some of those countries that are often touted as being so far ahead of the U.S. in education?
You know, it's not comparable because none of those countries have the degree of poverty we do. We often compare ourselves, for example, either to Korea or Japan or Finland. Those are three very high-performing countries, or Singapore. They don't have 25% of their kids living in poverty. In Finland, the poverty rate is under 5%. Here, it's something like 23%. So to say that somehow school spending is going to make up for the fact that kids are living in dire poverty, it's not going to happen. You know, if you look at what should we be doing to help these kids who are coming from poverty, they should have smaller class sizes. They should have experienced teachers. They should have early childhood education, which is crucial. I mean, in the state of Washington, every child in the state ought to have the opportunity to go to a good preschool center at ages 3 and 4. There are many things that could be done to help kids perform better in schools, and it does cost money.
Well, even if we don't have a number, I guess, can we assess overall that if Washington State's at 45th and has the kind of graduation rate it's getting, that Washington State has to substantially increase that per pupil expenditure?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got some of the richest people in America living in the state of Washington. Maybe they're not paying enough taxes.
But the individual, right, they're going to look at school and they're going to say, I'm paying $7,600 right now per pupil. Is it supposed to be 14,000, 20,000? I mean, people are going to want a number.
Yeah, well, I would say that when you're in the bottom of 50 states, you're not certainly not paying enough. And again, I'm not going to give you a number, whether it should be 9,000, 10,000, 12,000. It really depends on the district, and it depends on the level of need. And where you have kids who live in dire poverty, it's going to cost more. It should cost more because they need smaller classes. They need more attention. They need more help.
All right, Diane Ravitch, I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Diane Ravitch is a research professor of education at New York University, author of a number of books on education and education policy in this country, historian of education as well. This is Weekday.
If you plan to see the new Lincoln movie, listen closely. That's Lincoln's real pocket watch.
When this opportunity came up, I felt, well, here's a chance to get in touch with actual history.
I'm Guy Raz, capturing the actual sounds Lincoln heard in 1865. Next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's Weekend All Things Considered tomorrow evening, starting at 5 o'clock. Good morning, it's 9:36. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Symphony, presenting pianist Emmanuel Ax performing Brahms' Piano Concerto No. 2 with the symphony on November 15th, 17th, and 18th at Benaroya Hall. Tickets online at seattlesymphony.org.
Sunny skies and 44 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high today of 46. It's going to be sunny all day. Partly cloudy tonight, the low in the low 30s. Sunny again tomorrow, the high in the mid 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Kindred Healthcare, committed to continuing the care beyond a traditional hospital stay, including medically complex care, intensive care, and short-term rehab. More information at continuethecare.com.
John Adams is a Pulitzer Prize-winning American composer. He's in town to conduct the Seattle Symphony in a performance of his 1985 work, Harmonilera. Dave Beck spoke to him backstage at Benaroya Hall. Dave, good to see you. I didn't know the Founding Father was a composer.
Well, Steve, anytime I can show up at a classical music interview wearing my tri-cornered hat, you know that's a good day for me.
That is a good day.
Actually, John Adams, to his knowledge, he said in a New Yorker interview a few years ago, is not descended from John Adams, the Boston Adamses, as he said.
Oh, too bad.
But, you know, politics and world affairs and big ideas are part of his legacy. He wrote Nixon in China. He wrote The Death of Klinghoffer, a very controversial opera. And I was in New York City 4 years ago at this time to study his stuff in depth and be present for the premiere, the New York City premiere at the Met of Dr. Atomic. So he's somebody that fascinates me. And a lot of people will tell you he's the most, you know, celebrated and recognizable living American composer.
And yet he likes puns.
I've come to appreciate the wit just in the titles of his pieces. The Seattle Chamber Music Society did Hallelujah Junction, and it's a piece for two pianos. And reading up on that, Hallelujah Junction is the musical part of it is a kind of a musical punning on fragments from the Hallelujah chorus of Handel. But the way that John Adams got the title of the piece is that he was driving in the Sierra Mountains and came to a truck stop called Hallelujah Junction. And he said that is a title in search of a piece. And so he went ahead and created the piece, and it's a great one. And so it goes with this piece that he's doing in Seattle this weekend that he's conducting. He actually composed it in the early 1980s. It's called Harmonilera. And it's kind of a nod to a 1911 very classic academic text by Arnold Schoenberg about the study of academic harmony. But for John Adams, Harmonilera, the learning of harmony, is about, you know, personal harmony and contentment and sort of looking within. So it's, you know, he's always playing with those
ideas.
That's
pretty great.
In an interesting way.
All right. So, well, he's also what? He's doing some Beethoven too?
He is. He's doing he's conducting the entire program. And I got to watch him conduct the rehearsal of the Emperor Piano Concerto. There's a great pianist by the name of Jonathan Biss that's doing this classic work. And I was asking Adams about, you know, how do you program or how do the orchestras that present you program music that in some way reflects a contemporary piece by a living composer? And he said he feels a very strong kinship with Beethoven in terms of they're both very rooted in the past. I mean, Adams has deep academic training and graduate of Harvard and all that, but also very revolutionary in spirit in terms of using, you know, vernacular ideas and stuff that's out there in the culture. And he was referencing, you know, Hendrix and Chuck Berry and all the stuff that he grew up listening to. He's born in 1947, so he's a boomer. During his early years as a composer in San Francisco, John Adams said he would often end a day of immersion in new and experimental music by retreating to a place where he could sit and listen intently to the late string quartets of Beethoven.
Well, I didn't mean to say that I had to run home and, you know, and take it like one would take an aspirin or something. I mean, I just did notice that I was living a strange kind of double life, because I was promoting concerts and conducting concerts of Cage and Stockhausen. And you know, a lot of that music was enjoyable, and it was very, you know, exploratory and pushing the envelope, and I learned a lot from it. But what I noticed was that it was lacking one really essential thing, which was feeling. And I think that music, when you come right down to it, is the art of feeling. It's how we share our feelings more than with any other art form. And that's what I felt was lacking in avant-garde music. So I've tried to find a way to create a music that feels new and feels like it's a part of living in the 21st century, but that has that combination of deep feeling and also powerful energy. I have to just say as a footnote here that one of my most recent pieces, which I composed for the 100th anniversary of the San Francisco Symphony, is a piece called Absolute Jest, which is all based on fragments of scherzos from the late Beethoven quartets. And it's a work for string quartet and orchestra, which Michael Tilson Thomas premiered, and which I'm now going to tour with. I think my love and obsession will never stop.
I want to just end with a couple of questions about the genesis of Harmonia Lyra, because it was we talked about, you know, Beethoven, the spirit of Beethoven is hovering over the piece, but so much of it is rooted in dreams and almost visions that you had. And I wonder if that was kind of a product of the time, or if that's always how pieces get started. Specifically, one that really interests me is the birth of your daughter and images of her birth juxtaposed with this 12th, 13th century mystic Meister Eckhart. A lot of, you know, fascinating vision behind this piece.
Well, it was a product of my own personal history. I composed Harmonia Lyra in 1985, and I was still a relatively young composer at the time. And I'd had, after years of just being a complete nobody, living in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, I'd suddenly kind of arrived, and I'd had a lot of attention. I had my picture in Time magazine on an article about minimalism, which was very controversial at the time. And so suddenly I felt a great deal of pressure, and as a result, I had a year and a half of complete writer's block, and it became a very, very dark period for me. And I started working with a Jungian therapist, who was a very brilliant man, and he had me pay very close attention to my dreams and write them down. And these images, which were very expressive of certain mental and emotional states, stayed with me. And there are several of these images that launched the piece. There's the one you speak of the image of my daughter, who had literally just been born within, you know, a month or so of that finishing the piece. And another strange dream that I had about a big oil tanker in the middle of San Francisco Bay, and it's suddenly turning into a Saturn rocket and taking off vertically into space. Who knows what it means, but was certainly an image of enormous force and power, which obviously was what I needed to get out of this terrible funk. So it was a personal thing. But, you know, various things are responsible for the creation of works of art. Sometimes they're dreams, sometimes they're just mathematical constructs. Sometimes it's colors or images. So I can't say that there's any particular rule. I don't follow my dreams these days like I used to, but I do think that I strongly respond to certain kinds of visual and tactile images.
And I want to just get some specifics about then where that dream led you, because when you talk about the Saturn rocket, you talk about the color of the flame, and the middle movement is very much about an exploration of woundedness and reflections on that writer's block, and then the final movement, this kind of tenderness and exaltation at the birth of your daughter. What are the moments as you rehearse and perform and think about this piece almost 30 years later that stand out for you in terms of where you took that image and created sound out of it?
I don't think there's anything quite that specific. I mean, I recently was cleaning out our basement, and I found a box with all the original sketches in it, and I was astonished to see that I actually started the piece with different material than I've been telling people for 30 years that I didn't start with the pounding E minor chords, which I thought I did, but in fact I started with the trumpet solo in the second movement. So that kind of puts the lie to this idea of an orderly kind of Germanic procession through the creation of the piece. It's a piece that when I conduct it, I just go into a very special world, and music does that. When we hear pieces that we know, we go someplace. They take us to a place. If you hear a Mahler symphony, like I was watching this wonderful new movie by Terrence Malick on television the other night. I think it's called The Tree of Life. And there's a moment in it where you hear this music and you know immediately, oh, I know this piece. But it takes a split second before you realize what it is. And indeed, it's the opening to the Mahler first. But you hear that music and you emotionally immediately go to a certain place in your, whatever you call it, in your psyche. And music does that. And it has this astonishing ability for recall. Is something that Proust spent a lot of time talking about. He realized the ability of music to work in very special ways with our memory, our recall. And that's one of the magical things about music.
Harmony Lehre, John Adams. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. He spoke to Dave Beck. He's going to be in town to conduct the Seattle Symphony in a performance of this 1985 work. Two composers from America we have considered, both of which we have heard. We have to listen to them more than once, Elliot Carter and now John Adams. So I will be humming news, news, news from Nixon in China, and we will listen to those composers. We'll all reconvene and talk about what they meant to us, shall we? Because I think that would be interesting. We'll bring Dave back in here, and he can judge us on our work. Now, President Obama is going to be talking about the fiscal cliff and see how many ways that people can work that in as a metaphor. And that's coming up at 10 o'clock, and then we will review the news of the week following that conversation that the president has with the American people. I guess he is not going to be taking questions, which is different from, you may remember, when President Bush was reelected and he said he had some capital to spend. He was going to spend that political capital. We'll see if the president's going to talk about spending political capital or just hanging out with John Boehner. That'll come up at 10 o'clock, so stick around. And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
That sound, that's a pretty funny sound to hear, I thought, after John Adams. That sound comes from bicycle correspondent Willie Weir. He's on his first night in Mandalay. He and Kat, his wife, who are bicycling around in Myanmar soon and also other parts of Southeast Asia. He went up they went to eat at a roadside beer hall and a restaurant, and the band was warming up. And from the initial notes, Willie was expecting to hear the local music of Myanmar, so he was a little surprised to hear, but I don't know why, since it's such a universal sound, a rendition of Billy Idol's White Wedding instead. Now, can't you not love that? You're in the middle of Mandalay, Willie writes, and here we're listening to White Wedding, Hey Little Sister. So, you can see a picture of the band from Mandalay. It's on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Search for that. You can see, I don't know if he's got white hair and those pursed lips that old Billy had, but I'm sure from listening to that rendition, he knows the Billy Idol sensibility. That was in Mandalay on their first night there. What surprising sounds are you hearing, or interesting sounds, or, you know, just sounds you cannot believe somebody is making? You have a three-day weekend coming up, so maybe you have some Veterans Day activities you want to share with us, or you'll be taking a hike, you'll be running some errands. We want to experience your world through sound, so if you have some sound to share with us, why don't you share some sound with us? Record 30 seconds of it, email those sounds to us, weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We want to hear your world. Nick Bond, what does your world sound like?
Well, this morning it sounded like people scraping ice off their windshields.
Really? That wasn't happening down in my neck of the woods. Where was that happening?
Well, I live in North Seattle, and even though the temperatures didn't quite get down to freezing, it did get cold enough to kind of frost up the windows and all that. I'm on my bicycle, so I don't have anything to scrape off.
But it was a little chilly, wasn't it, Nick?
Yeah, and we have today's going to be kind of on the chilly side, but mostly sunny, and I think that's a pretty good bargain for most folks. Temperatures in the mid-40s, which is about 5 degrees cooler than normal, and we're going to have one more chilly night with the cold spots getting well into the 20s, and the kind of hilltop locations like SeaTac and Painfield and so forth flirting with the freezing mark. And so that one more cold night and another cold, sunny day on Saturday, but then it'll cloud up overnight Saturday night, and Sunday will be a cloudy day with rain developing in the afternoon sometime.
Does that mean we're going to see a shift in where the weather has been coming from?
Well, yeah, right now it's mostly from the north, the kind of low-level flow. And in fact, today there's going to be probably some pretty fresh breezes from the north and in the North Sound, but that's all changing. We're going to be getting a system coming in off the Pacific and then showers from Sunday night into Monday. And next week looks like a kind of standard issue week for the Pacific Northwest, with highs near 50 and lows near 40 and rain at times. And you've experienced this before.
Yeah. You know, sometimes we get the kind of weather we've had the last couple of days around Thanksgiving, even on the coast. Any chance? I know it's 2 weeks away, but what do you think?
No, I don't see anything but, you know, occasional weak to moderate storms coming through for the next week or two. And you're right, though. Thanksgiving is far enough away, all bets are off.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us to talk about the weather. So, Nick, how rare is it to get these frosts in November?
Yeah, this time of year is about when we get the first frost at places like SeaTac and kind of the warmer locations. And so while you might think that, winter is here, it's really only about 5 to 10% of the days does it get the temperature actually get down to freezing. It's a different story at the cold spots like Olympia, Arlington, and some of the kind of more protected interior valley locations, and they'll start getting these frosts in early October. And so, but then as we get later into the month, the incidence of frosts on at least the clear, calm nights goes way up. And if we have those kind of nights from late November on, then we're pretty good bet of getting a frost.
You were saying we should maybe consider that there's some value in this cold weather, especially for the gardens, huh?
Right. And, of course, an obvious benefit is that a lot of the plants we like are adapted to a seasonal cycle, and they need a dormant period to harden off buds and that sort of thing. So rely on winter cold temperatures. But also from the point of view of pests, and I'm thinking here of my mortal foe, the slug. Now,
really?
My understanding
he's
is
your foe? He's your mortal foe?
It's my mortal foe, and you can ask my wife. She'll back me up on this one. But I understand the native slugs don't do that much damage, but the European imports, boy, they can lay waste to a lettuce patch quite quickly. And they their eggs, at least, are susceptible to cold and dry weather. And so the colder the winter that we have, the less of these eggs are survive the next spring to hatch out and devastate my garden.
All right, so I'll feel good about that aspect of the cold for you. Did you have your gloves on this morning when you were riding your bike?
Oh yeah,
yeah. It was a real reminder that we're heading towards winter, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
My ears were cold. All right, Nick, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Nick Bond, he is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Center. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with a look at the science behind the weather and some of the history behind the weather, and also a weather outlook every Friday on weekday on KUOW Seattle. Say, by the way, the Orchestra Seattle and the Seattle Chamber Singers, they're going to be performing at 7:30 on Saturday night the Chairman Dances from Nixon in China. So a little more John Adams for you to enjoy if you're thinking about John Adams and his work. We're going to have a couple of specials on Monday for Veterans Day, including an episode from the State of the Reunion. They're going to go into the foothills, the Appalachian foothills of Ohio, where for a century people have shared the common bond of identifying as African-American, despite the fact that they look white. Racial lines have been blurred there almost to invisibility, they say, and people inside the same family can vehemently disagree about whether they're black or white. It can be tense, confusing. As a result, everyone's choosing, adding to the confusion. Now some of those people are saying they're Native American as well. So that's one of the shows we'll be bringing you on Monday for our Veterans Day. We'll be off. And then on Tuesday, speaking of veterans and thinking, Thomas Ricks has written a book about the generals, a very critical book about how the Pentagon operates. He says they're not firing enough generals. They're not firing enough people who fail at their work and then allowing for new, younger people to come up and try out. Something that happened, of course, with Lincoln, something that happened a little bit in World War II once they started doing it. But he said of late, especially pointing to Iraq and pointing to Afghanistan, they are not doing that. And Mark Bowden will join us on Thursday. He'll be talking about what's going to be what happened with Osama bin Laden and what we might expect next. And then on Friday, Taj Mahal is going to be here. A conversation with Taj Mahal. We'll play some of his music, and he'll talk about his career. A lot of stuff next week. This is 94.9 KOW Seattle. The president's speaking in a couple of minutes, and then we'll review the news. Stay with us.
It's a minute before 10. As you just heard, the president is expected to speak in just a couple minutes about the so-called fiscal cliff. We'll bring you live coverage coming up.
Support for KUOW comes from UW School of Public Health, joining Public Health Seattle and King County with the message that depression is a common, often ignored, and potentially fatal condition, but prompt care can help save lives.
You want to control kids' behavior? And some schools, keeping score works pretty well.
Incidents of physical aggression have gone down. Incidents of disrespect have gone down. Students are more aware of the rules, expectations, and procedures that we have in our classroom.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Scoreboards in the Classroom. Next time on Marketplace, it's from 8 p.m.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Real Networks Foundation, the Koenigsegg Goldman Foundation, the Cape Flattery Foundation, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.